Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Greil Marcus, writer, historian. With Verna Solars, he is the editor of A New Literary History of America. And we're talking about his new book, Under the Red, White, and Blue, Patriotism, Disenchantment, and the Stubborn Myth of the Great Gatsby. Greil, it's a pleasure to be talking to you again about this book.
Well, it's good to be talking with you, Mark.
What brought you to write this book? I think most people, when they think about you, they think about your critical writing about music, not just rock, but American music and world music. And the idea of you writing a book about literary topics really initially surprised me, but then once I got into it, it really swung. Talk to me about you writing this.
Well, my first book, which was called Mystery Train, came out in 1975, had a couple of paragraphs in a chapter about the 1930s blues singer Robert Johnson, had a couple of paragraphs about the Great Gatsby, just kind of setting a scene and merging a blues singer into a literary context. There was an affinity there. And really, this book came out of those couple of paragraphs. They were always suggestive, at least to me, that there was always more that I wanted to say about this book, which I had read so many times, and which I just, you know, saw appearing in the culture at large in so many different ways over my whole lifetime, I guess. But it really began, this particular book, with this story in the New York Times, which is what the book opens with. And it's from 2013, and it was a story about how with the Baz Luhrmann movie adaptation of The Great Gatsby just about to come out, there were two different covers of new editions of The Great Gatsby. One had the traditional cover that it was originally published with in 1925, but it was still a new edition. It was a kind of subtle movie tie-in. But the other was the gross movie tie-in with Leonardo DiCaprio and all the other actors in the Baz Luhrmann film. And the story was about what places were carrying which edition. And Walmart was carrying the one with Leonardo DiCaprio. But McNally Jackson, which is a downtown New York City independent bookstore, was only carrying the traditional one. And the writer of this story, her name was Julie Bosman, interviewed a book buyer at McNally Jackson. He was just, you know, oh, we would never carry this. You know, it's so vulgar, and it's a degradation of a classic of American literature, and our customers just wouldn't stand for it. She was clearly put off by this. And she said, well, do you think it would be acceptable to be seen reading the book with Leonardo DiCaprio on the cover, riding on the subway? And the guy took the bait, and he said, oh, I think anyone should be ashamed.
Wow.
And I thought, my God, you know, it's better not to read the book at all than to read it with the wrong cover? What are we talking about? And so that just opened up into thinking about the book. I had already seen Gatz, this six-hour...
Well, we're going to talk about that. Don't see, yeah.
I had seen the Baz Luhrmann movie a couple weeks later, which I just loved. And I thought, God, people are still arguing about this book almost 100 years later. Isn't that wonderful? And I wanted to dive into that argument.
Well, and it's why it's so important in America is what your book is about. Is like, what does it say about who gets to dream the American dream? It's funny about the Baz Luhrmann. I never saw that film until I started to read your book, and then I immediately watched it. And I ended up thinking it was the best film version so far.
Oh, I think, you know, by miles and miles.
Well, the things I learned in your books, because you always have these great digressions. I never knew there was a silent version in 1926.
And unfortunately, it's lost. All that remains is the trailer, which is pretty good.
What about the 1949 Alan Ladd? And I haven't seen that one either.
Well, that was, you know...
First of all, Alan Ladd is Great Gatsby?
Right, right. That was knocking around in Hollywood pretty much ever since sound came in. People wanted to make a soundy version of The Great Gatsby. And even in the 40s, people were still talking about it that way. And Raymond Chandler, the mystery writer, who in his own way rewrote The Great Gatsby in his last real novel, The Long Goodbye, he was a screenwriter in Hollywood. He thought he was going to get a chance to do this because it was a book he loved. It didn't work out. And finally, the movie was made in 1949 with Alan Ladd. And it was, God, it's so stiff. It's painful to watch.
Well, Alan Ladd doesn't seem to be the kind of person you'd want as a lead. I mean, he was a weird actor to begin with.
Well, there are interesting things about it. In some ways, The Great Gatsby, the novel, is really the first noir novel.
Yep.
And it is a precursor to all the noir films of the 1940s and 50s. And Alan Ladd was a very central noir actor,
right?
In the Blue Dahlia and any number of other movies. So in that sense, maybe people could say, "Oh, this makes sense." But there are so many shadings in the role of Gatsby that were just beyond Alan Ladd. whether it was romance, whether it was regret, whether it was a sense of vengeance, or a philosophical character, which is at the core of Gatsby. And, you know, I think the thing was just a complete bust from beginning to end. There's nobody good in this movie.
Oh, my God. This book, is about the novels, and this is in your own words, the gravitational pull that's colonized the imagination. I haven't read the book since, I think, college. But I still know it. And it's still part of my imagination. And you talk about that. Even if you haven't read the book, you've sort of essentially read the book. It's like Moby Dick, which is the sort of bookend novels that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, there are stories that have come out of the American imagination, the American experience, that have so crystallized our experiment, our dilemma, whatever you want to call it, the bizarre situation of a nation that made itself up, that invented itself, and passed on this opportunity or this burden to every citizen, that you too can be America yourself. You can invent yourself. You can make yourself up. You can become a new person. And that is the great American epic, really, whether it's played out on a tiny screen or the broadest expanse. And so when there are certain stories like Moby Dick or The Great Gatsby that crystallize this so perfectly in such a striking and original manner, those stories filter through everyone's imagination in the same way that there are certain symbols. In a way, the Declaration of Independence functions in our imagination more as a symbol of freedom than as an actual textual document that we parse to say, what does this really mean? And with Moby Dick, the idea, you know, here is this mad captain in a quest to kill the white whale, and he enlists people of all sorts to go with him. And that speaks for the sense that America has this insane destiny to bring enlightenment to the rest of the world. Then you have The Great Gatsby, which is really just about one guy who's hung up on this one woman, and yet his attempt to realize his dream of being united with her comes to symbolize, enact, and speak for all of our failed ambitions and wishes and our fantasies about what we could be or could have been if things had just been a little bit different. If we'd been born to better parents, for example. And there's this wonderful line in The Great Gatsby where Nick Carraway, the narrator, says that Gatsby never accepted his parents as his real parents. He was too big. He was too brilliant. He was too full of desire. How could these dull, ordinary people have actually produced him? He had to be a foundling, you know, everybody's fantasy that your parents aren't really your parents, that somehow your true destiny is hidden from you, even though you can feel it in your heart. So that these are stories that people refer to. Someone on a doomed quest. Well, he's a Gatsby.
Right.
Even if you haven't read that book, that metaphor is part of your character and your whole frame of references to what it means to be an American.
You call it a great common art project. And again, it extends to Moby Dick, Mad Men. Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye. I've never read The Long, but I only saw the film. In what way is Chandler's The Long Goodbye the fulfillment of the same kind of art project?
Well, the movie really has nothing to do with
it. I couldn't believe it would. I do love the movie, though, on its own grounds.
I could run down all of the parallels, but essentially Chandler takes a Gatsby figure, someone who is transformed by the war, who fell in love with a woman, lost her. She ended up marrying somebody else, and he comes back. His figure Terry Lennox comes back into her life, and it ends with the same kind of murders that The Great Gatsby ends with.
Yep.
And Philip Marlowe, the detective, ends up fulfilling the Nick Carraway role. And Terry Lennox, who is this really disreputable character, in a way that Nick talks about Gatsby as being the sort of person I would ordinarily abhor and never go near, you know, just something, you know, uncouth and wrong about this guy. And yet he manages to have a glow around him, and he makes you feel more alive and more of yourself than you know, just by looking at you. And Chandler talks about Terry Lennox, this drunk, this wastrel, this tortured person. He said he was a man it was impossible to dislike. And how many people can you say that of? And both novels are about love stories between two men, between, you know, we can say the detective and the gangster. Nick Carraway is very much a detective. And both Terry Lennox and Gatsby, that, you know, they have these pals they've made in the war. They have these mob contacts who are backing them up. So, you know, Chandler just finally said, "I can't write. They're not going to let me write the movie. I'm going to write the damn book."
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Greil Marcus, writer and historian. He's one of the editors of A New Literary History of America. But tonight we're talking about his new book, Under the Red, White, and Blue, Patriotism, Disenchantment, and the Stubborn Myth of the Great Gatsby. Greil, talk to me about the title of the book, Under the Red, White, and Blue.
Right before the book was due to be published, The Great Gatsby, in 1925, it came out in April of that year. In March, Fitzgerald sent a telegram to his publisher saying, "Crazy about the title, Under the Red, White, and Blue. What would the delay be? So at the very last minute, he wants to change the title of the book when it's, you know, it's already in press. And his publisher says, well, you know, it's really kind of late. And anyway, The Great Gatsby is a better title. And Fitzgerald says, yeah, okay, I guess so. But I came across this telegram in a collection of Fitzgerald letters, and it just sort of went off like a bomb.
Right, right.
That the ambition of the book, Fitzgerald's conscious ambition for the book, was to tell the American story from beginning to end in a complete manner, as acted out by just a handful of characters. That was what he thought he was doing. That's what he wanted to be doing. He wanted to make this book as much an American song as the Star Spangled Banner, which had, you know, a distant cousin of his had written. F. Scott Fitzgerald stands for Francis Scott Fitzgerald, just as Francis Scott Key wrote the national anthem. Fitzgerald set out to write a new national anthem, and he succeeded.
What was the reception of the book when it was first released?
Well, he had had a huge hit with This Side of Paradise in 1922, and it was about his Princeton years, and it was really about wild youth. And it was, for the time, it was shocking just to see how, you know, these dissolute people at a fancy East Coast university, and the lives they led, and that were both nihilistic, purposeless, and unbelievably alluring. And it was a huge bestseller, and it set him up, and it made him a celebrity. He was making a lot of money. Then he, in 1923, I think, he published The Beautiful and Damned, which is a much, much better novel, and it was successful too, not as successful, but it was a tremendous piece of work. And then 1925, and you know, this is productive.
This is a
book every year or so, and he's still a young man. And he publishes The Great Gatsby, and he has more ambition for it than the other books. But you know, it's slight. It's barely. It, you know, I can't remember if it's, you know, I think it's 55,000 words or something like that. So it's a very, very short novel. It doesn't look big or impressive, and it wasn't big or impressive, and it didn't sell well. A lot of the reviews were essentially saying, well, gee, we've heard this story before. That's right. You have heard this story before. That was the whole idea. It's our story. So it didn't, it was a failure.
But when did when did it gain the cachet, the importance, the gravitas, so that today people go crazy if it's a film of it is being done by Buzz?
Well, you know, it wasn't until after Fitzgerald died in 1940.
Okay.
And died very young, I think at 44. It wasn't until, and when he died, all of his books were out of print, maybe with the exception of This Side of Paradise, the first one. It wasn't until after he died that certain people, particularly in Hollywood, where he had lived as trying to make a living as a screenwriter and failing, that people began to talk about it. People began to kick it around. You have another movie in 1949. And the book, you know, begins to be talked about. There are critical reevaluations by, you know, scholars. And then in the 50s, it begins to be assigned in high schools,
right,
as you know, one of these American fables that we all had to read in high school. Now, I was in California. We weren't reading The Great Gatsby, but my wife, who grew up in St. Paul, well, they already were assigning it in Minnesota in the 50s and early 60s. So it became part of the general experience. And I found when I began to read interviews with the people involved in the works that I was focusing on, the Baz Luhrmann movie, the Gatz theatrical reading of the book.
Yeah, that sounded, you know, I'd never heard of that until your description of it, and that sounded fascinating.
Well, and the various actors involved in these projects would all say, well, when I read it in high school, I thought. And so it becomes this common experience.
It's interesting because we're going to run out of time.
Okay.
You tried to get at first, what is this American thing that he's trying to get at in The Great Gatsby and all the other people are trying to get at in their projects, this life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which, as you write, is what the rest of the world understands by America. And you also write that there's a way in which you see every American story as a version of the Declaration of Independence, to make it true or to prove it a lie. And that sort of seems to get at the nub of why projects and art like this seem to always be getting at us, because it is that sort of dynamic tension between making it true or proving it a lie.
Yeah, and I think when we reach the end of The Great Gatsby, in whatever version we're reading or looking at, we don't know the answer.
We are
lifted up. We're still inspired by the story, by the quest. And yet you realize that it leaves behind ruin and devastation. And, Nick Carraway in some ways is very much an Ishmael figure. I alone remain to tell the tale. So what I realized, reading the book again and again while I was writing this book, but particularly watching the Baz Luhrmann movie and the very end of Gatz, the six-hour theatrical reading, there was something that hadn't quite come alive for me before, and that was that how this is a true tragedy. And it leaves you bereft and leaves you empty, leaves you defeated in a way that, you know, Moby Dick compared to The Great Gatsby is like an Abbott and Costello movie. It is a comedy in a lot of ways.
And well, let's get a Craig Gatsby chase scene at the end.
Oh, yeah, it's like Bullet.
One of the things that I love about your writing is that you seemingly effortlessly bring in so many threads. And one of the things I really appreciated was the retelling of Andy Kaufman's March 8th, 1978 performance on Saturday Night Live. Because that gets to the same, in a weird meta way, the same theme about, he's got this time, people are expecting him to perform, and I actually watched that. And he pulls out and starts reading The Great Gatsby. And the audience initially thinks it's funny. And then it starts degenerating. And then he keeps threatening to stop. And everybody cheers. But then he keeps going back to it. There's something really interesting. He didn't pick The Great Gatsby arbitrarily. That was a purposeful choice.
Well, he picked it because he knew that everybody in the audience would have read it.
That's right.
Would have had to read it in high school. And so he's going to take these people and put them right back in school. And he's going to enforce them to read a book, to listen to a book they'd already been forced to read. So, you know, what else could he have chosen that would have been part of everybody's frame of reference? And you know, it's interesting, when he starts reading the book to this crowd of people, and you realize how dull the opening of the book is.
It's awful. It's awful.
You know, like, you know, in my younger days, I received a piece of advice from my father, and it's like, oh, you're already asleep. And so he's trying to read the book, and people are, you know, booing and groaning and yelling at him. And it's just awful. And by the time he finally has to end, and in this you know, 15-minute segment or however how long it is, maybe 20 minutes, he only gets through about a page and a half of the book because he's fighting with the crowd, it actually starts to get interesting. And you realize there might actually be a story here. And I had forgotten that. I had seen it when it happened, but I had completely forgotten about it. And I ran across it, and I watched it, and I thought, no way I'm not including every word of this. Because if nothing else, it's great. People got to have to know about it. You know, I'm not very proprietary writing a book. I don't care whose voice it is. I'm perfectly happy to turn the book over to Andy Kaufman. Because, you know, he can do it better than I can.
What was interesting is finally, after reading the book, you then go back to the Buzz Luhrmann at the end of your book and go through reasons why it's a better film production. And so having not seen it, I had to watch it. And I'm glad I read your book first, but even if I hadn't, it was a good movie of The Great Gatsby.
And it's so daring. It's so full of imagination. And you need when you take up material that is precious to so many people, or just part of them, even if it isn't precious, you have to be willing to do violence to it.
Exactly.
You can't approach it in a worshipful, reverent manner. You have to say, what's my response to this? That's the story I have to tell. I don't need to tell the story of how other people have reacted to this. I have to rewrite the book myself, which is what I did, is what Baz Luhrmann did.
That's right.
Raymond Chandler, so many other people.
Unfortunately, we're completely out of time, Greil. We could talk about your book for quite some time, and I strongly recommend people read this book. There's a lot in here. My guest tonight has been Greil Marcus, writer, historian. He is the editor of A New Literary History of America. I'm going to have to talk to you again about that because I'd love to know more about that.
Well, I'd love to talk to you. This has been so much fun.
We've been talking about his new book, and there's something about your writing that makes it an experience to read it. Under the Red, White, and Blue, Patriotism, Disenchantment, and the Stubborn Myth of the Great Gatsby. Greil, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.